I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
A Rayo Original Podcast.
The greatest blocker we ever experience is the blocker that's internal. We are notoriously bad at giving ourselves advice. We don't get what we want or what we deserve. We get what we believe.
Because self-doubt is always going to be there, right? But it's how we choose to respond to it that is really going to determine where we end up.
There's not even one voice. There's actually five of them. Five inner critical voices. We call them the inner deceivers because they're trying to deceive you and make you believe something that simply is not true.
We live in a world of self-optimization.
Everything you do is a choice. If there's something you're not happy with in your life, you can choose to do something about it. If you don't choose you, why should you expect anyone else to choose you?
Hello and welcome back to Rise with Roxy. This week on Rise with Roxy, I'm joined by one of the world's leading voices on confidence psychology, Dr. Shade Zarai. She's a former commercial lawyer and banker who, despite ticking every box of success, secretly felt like a hiring mistake, an imposter, someone who didn't belong. Now she's a behavioral researcher with a PhD in organizational behavior, a TEDx speaker with over 300 million views, and she's the author of Big Trust. Shade helps people rewire the internal narratives that keep them stuck in self-doubt. Because confidence isn't about becoming someone new. It's about trusting who you already are. Before we start the conversation, could I just ask you, please, if you can, to just hit that follow button or share the episode or leave a comment at the end if you enjoy it. All these little things really do go a long way for us, and it means that we can come back with more seasons, with better guests, and more hopefully helpful and interesting conversations for you to learn from. Okay, let's get into the episode. Shade, thank you so much for being a guest on Rise with Roxy.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you spent over a decade working sort of behind closed doors with loads of senior leaders from Google, Microsoft, JP Morgan, McKinsey. And I suppose people like that are people that we would look at and think, wow, these guys or women have got it all figured out. They are so successful. They know what they're doing. But is it the case that behind closed doors with all these senior leaders and people that we think that about, is that the reality?
Short answer, no. They hide it really well, but what we found is actually the more advanced someone has become in their careers, the more visible they are, the more self-doubt they experience. They've just become really good at quietening it and trying to keep moving forward anyway, which has allowed them to achieve a certain degree of success, but it makes every step so much more difficult for them. So we basically determined self-doubt doesn't really ever disappear. It scales with responsibility.
Yeah.
Which then means the key that we need to figure out is how do we acknowledge that it's there and still create that momentum, still take those steps, still go for the opportunities? Because the moment it holds us back is the moment things start to crumble because we lose that trust in ourselves. So that's been a big insight for us.
It's so interesting because it makes me think of that. I don't know if you ever watched the Lewis Capaldi documentary on Netflix, but he speaks about how on the second album, the pressure was so intense because the first album had done so well. So where he could actually enjoy writing the first album, the second album, where you'd think you'd seen, my God, I'm obviously good because look at the success. You'd think that would make you feel better, but actually it made him feel worse and it really exacerbated sort of his mental health struggles. And I thought that was such a clear example of this in action, where the more visible you get, actually, like you've just articulated, the more doubtful you become.
Completely. And it's so interesting that so much of that doubt is from us. I mean, of course, you will have people around you expecting more of you the more you achieve, but so much of it is from us. And the greatest blocker we ever experience is the blocker that's internal, because it shapes how we're showing up. It shapes how creative we feel we can be. It also shapes what we think is good enough. And generally people that are very successful, and I'm sure Louis Capaldi felt it too, and the leaders that we've worked with have felt it too, they never quite feel that what they're doing is good enough. Mm. And so, again, they've got that self-criticism because they're perfectionists and they have these insanely high standards. And again, it just becomes this huge cycle, which makes life so much more difficult.
Yeah. It kind of feels like when you're starting out as a beginner, you have self-doubt because you feel like you're not experienced enough. And then when you get successful, you have self-doubt because you've got more expectations on yourself and from other people. And so it feels like we're all fucked.
Yes, basically. So, moral of the story.
So what I want to know is, why did we actually evolve to have self-doubt in the first place? You know, what is self-doubt there to do?
In short, in its simplest, it's to protect us. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit more, which I think is really interesting to understand. So if we look at the role of the brain, most people will say the goal of the brain is to protect you and keep you safe. That's true to an extent, but it's even simpler than that. The role of the brain is to make sure that every part of our body does what it needs to do so that we survive, but using the least amount of metabolic energy. Mm-hmm. So what that means for the brain is that if it can anticipate everything that could go wrong, because it doesn't like uncertainty, because uncertainty takes a lot of energy for it to process. Mm-hmm. If it can anticipate, okay, well, this could go wrong, that could go wrong, that's a risk, this will happen, then it means, for the brain's sake, it will need less energy when the consequence arises because it's already anticipated what's coming.
Interesting.
So when we understand that the brain is just doing its job, suddenly we have a whole new appreciation for why it does that. Mm-hmm. The risk, though, is when we listen to that catastrophizing and the what ifs and this is terrible and you'll never be enough. We listen to it as if it's a fact, as if it's evidence that we cannot do this thing. We are not worthy of it. We're not capable. It's not for us. And then we keep ourselves safe. And you know what? To the brain, safe is great because it's less energy. But safe means we are not growing. We are stagnant and we're holding ourselves back. And we see this so often, and it is heartbreaking because the thing with these little micro decisions that we make where we decide to hesitate or overthink or hold back, the impact in the moment may not be great. You know, like, I'm not going to speak up in this meeting, or I'm not going to try and negotiate this. But that cumulative effect over the course of someone's life, when they're then looking back on these micro decisions that suddenly have shaped their entire life, that's when we see the real cost of self-doubt. It's a life of regret, of shrinking, of knowing that you were capable of more, but not backing yourself enough to actually do that. And it's heartbreaking.
Is anybody free from self-doubt?
The interesting thing with self-doubt is when we measure it, we require people to fill out a survey, essentially, like a psychometrically validated tool, which allows us to determine how much self-doubt someone has. So it requires self-awareness, and it requires humility, and someone being willing to actually acknowledge, hey, maybe I have self-doubt. Mm-hmm. So we find that around 90 to 95% of people will show in their results, yes, they have self-doubt, which means there's about 5 to 8% of people that don't show up as having self-doubt. These are often people who are sociopaths. We see a lot of narcissism coming up here. But the interesting thing about narcissism is that this is often, for many of them, it's a sign of self-loathing, which is actually a reflection of a deeply held sense of self-doubt and inadequacy. And it comes across as grandiosity and superiority, but that's not going to come up when we assess for that.
Yeah.
So I would say for healthy functioning people, self-doubt is completely natural.
In a way, if you have self-doubt, at least you're not a sociopath.
Exactly. Yay for,
yay for us. I found this fascinating, and I just want to go straight into it because you talk about inner deceivers.
Yes.
And I absolutely loved, you've got the judge, the victimizer, the misguided protector, the ringmaster, and the neglector. And these are all different voices in our heads that try to protect us. I love this. And I know it's a lot to ask you, but can we go through
this? Yes, of course. Okay, this is never a lot to ask me. I love talking about this. So I'm going to take you a few years back. I became obsessed with understanding self-doubt, mainly because I have a lot of it myself. And I kept seeing it come up in all of these leaders, people that I thought had it sorted out. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I really want to understand this voice that everyone is hearing. So I conducted hundreds of interviews with people to really understand what is the voice. And I discovered there's not even one voice. There's actually five of them. Mm-hmm. Five inner critical voices. We call them the inner deceivers because they're trying to deceive you and make you believe something that simply is not true. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we believe them. We think that they're fact. Yeah. So we identified these five archetypes. Let me take you through them. And right. if anyone is watching or listening, see if any of these relate to an experience you've had. So the first one is the classic judge. This is the default voice of judgment. You can't do that. You should have done this. You're too old. You're too young. You're too fat. You're too skinny. Nothing you do will satisfy the classic judge. Mm-hmm. So this is usually the standard. Anyone that experiences self-doubt, it will probably be this mm-hmm. at some point. That's our first voice. The second voice that we find comes up is what we call the misguided protector. The role of the misguided protector, just as the name suggests, is to protect us from harm. Mm-hmm. But it's misguided because how it does that is magnify everything that could go wrong and all the ways that you will fall short and why it will never work out. Because if it can do that, then you won't take action. So guess what? You're safe, but you're also stuck and stagnant. Mm. That's why it's misguided. The victimizer is a super interesting one. And actually, we started dropping this out of the list of the five of them because we found people struggle to identify this in themselves because the role of the victimizer is to make you feel like a perpetual victim. Why is life so difficult for me? Why is life so unfair? There's this narrative of why me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't want you to take ownership. It doesn't want you to take responsibility. So you will often get stuck in complaining or frustration or blame. Now, when we talk to people, very few of them will self-identify and say, yep, that's me. Mm-hmm. Because you need a lot of humility to be able to say that.
Yeah.
But most people will say, oh, I know someone like that.
Yeah.
I know someone like that. So that's the victimizer. It's the one that doesn't want you to acknowledge that there's always something you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets you to complain.
Yeah.
The fourth one, the ringmaster. The ringmaster is that voice that we hear that tells us you have not done enough. You need to keep pushing. It's that part of us that feels guilty when we try and take a break. It's that part of us that attaches our sense of identity on our work. And it says, you will feel satisfied and enough when you get there. So we set the goal, we get there, and then it doesn't bring that sense of satisfaction and fulfillment that we were seeking. And then suddenly we feel empty again, so we just set the next goal. So we're on this constant treadmill, hedonic treadmill. And then the fifth voice that we hear is the neglector. The neglector is the voice that tries to convince you that everyone else is more important than you. That everyone else's needs are more important than yours, and you should basically sacrifice yourself to make sure everyone else is happy, because they come first. And if they're happy, then maybe you're acceptable. Mm. And we see this a lot in anyone who is in a caring responsibility, anyone who is in a position of leadership who has more of that servant leadership style, or anyone who has been in a relationship where they have been taken advantage of, and they're so lacking in this sense of, hey, I deserve better or I am enough, that they become codependent and they basically put up with manipulation because they don't feel like there's anything they can do to change their situation.
Mm.
You're nothing. Make this person happy.
Yeah.
And it's, again, heartbreaking when we have these voices. Even more heartbreaking when we think that they are us and we make them a part of our identity.
Mm.
And that's the real danger of self-doubt. It's not having it. Having these voices is not the problem. It's the fact that we then make it mean something about us. We internalize it, and actually it shapes our self-identity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the worst thing we can do.
Yeah.
So then the next question would be, well, what do you do? If you, like, we have people that are hearing this, no doubt, and going, hold on, that's me. I have that voice. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll quickly just share a few little tools that come from the research.
Go.
The key is acknowledging you are not your thoughts. You don't have to believe every thing that comes into your mind.
I always say your inner critic is not to be trusted.
Yes, beautifully said. Mm. Don't trust that voice. Don't trust every thought you have. The first thing we encourage you to do, I have this little visual. I don't play a lot of sports, but imagine you have a baseball bat or a cricket bat or paddle ball or whatever kind of sport you like. Imagine that thought coming to you as if it's a ball. And then what you want to do is whack it away. And when you're whacking it away, you basically say, thank you, misguided protector, classic judge, neglector. I know you're there. I know that's you. But no thanks. I don't need your help. Mm-hmm. I don't need your protection. So that's the first step, which just creates a little bit of psychological separation, which mm-hmm. is important to acknowledge. This is a thought. This is not me. And when you refer to it as the voice, again, you're acknowledging this is not who I am.
That's really important for people listening to kind of explain how powerful this is, because I think for some people the thought of doing that, having a visualization of batting away a thought, seems silly or seems like I just don't get how naming it is going to do anything. Could you just explain, like, why this actually works? It's not something that is just sounds good. It is a tool that will actually minimize the power that voice has over you.
There's two levels, two ways to look at it. I'm going to start with the kind of visual imagery, and then I'm going to start with, or then I'm going to share what's going on in the brain. Mm-hmm. The voices that we hear, we will hear them as I am, mm-hmm. right? So we might hear one of these archetypes, one of these inner deceivers that speak to us, and rather than hearing it as you are not enough, we hear it as I am not enough, which then again makes us internalize it. So when you're imagining that you've got that bat, you're saying, I see you, classic judge. You're telling me you are this, you are that. And that in itself has been shown to create a separation between your identity and the thoughts that you have. Mm-hmm. And what's beautiful is there's this concept called metacognition, which is this incredible ability that I think everyone would benefit from improving. It's becoming aware of your thoughts, not becoming embroiled in them. Mm-hmm. You have this awareness and this curiosity towards your thoughts, which allows you to, again, create that separation. So there's that element. But then if we look at what's going on in the brain, when we hear these inner critical voices, it doesn't feel great. Our body responds emotionally. And again, it all happens like it's out of our control. That's because what's happening is the blood is rushing to the emotion centers in the brain, the fear detection centers in the brain, the catastrophizing centers. So blood is rushing there. And that's, you know, when we say this part of the brain is activated, mm-hmm. that largely means that there's blood rushing to that area.
Right.
So there are all of these things happening there. Blood has rushed there. The moment you take conscious control of your mind, blood is rushing to the prefrontal regions of your brain. So blood is moving away from the threat detection centers, the fear detection centers, and it's actually just moving to the front parts because that's where the activity is happening. And when that happens, because there's less blood in the other areas, activity drops and we feel less anxious and we feel less stressed and we feel less like everything is outside of our control. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of attention and consciously driving our attention. So I like to say the weirder the analogy or the weirder the visualization, sometimes the better. Mm-hmm. Because it forces you to feel a little uncomfortable to try and visualize this thing. Even if you don't feel it in the moment, mm-hmm. just know that your brain is responding to that.
Yeah.
And it's naturally going to have the effect of reducing how negative you feel in that moment and how strongly that voice has taken over and gear you towards more of that rational thinking.
That is incredible. So helpful for people. So helpful. I think it's one thing to know what to do, but it's understanding how that works that really gets people to kind of go, okay, fuck it, I'm going to give it a try.
That's what we want. We want everyone in this listening to this to go, that's it, I'm doing it, I'm doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, what was the next tool you were going to share then?
Okay, the next one is a little more not complex, but it allows us to go a little deeper. Mm-hmm. So in the moment, we say that. We go, not now. Mm-hmm. But then it's also really helpful to actually process what happened and why. You don't want to do this in the moment because you're going to be overwhelmed by the emotional state. But when you have some time to reflect, I encourage you to get a pen and a piece of paper. I am a big believer in going back to kind of analog.
Yeah.
It just activates different parts of the brain. Interesting side point, research has also come out. There was a study in 2021, and it found that if you want to remember something, you're going to have so much more luck remembering it if you actually grab a pen and a physical piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So I find that journaling, gratitude, everything you can do physically is incredibly beneficial.
Yeah.
So what you do is grab your piece of paper and you work through this process of self-inquiry. Now, I spent the last 5 years deep diving into self-doubt, and I've got this book called Big Trust, which goes into a lot more of this detail, and we provide mm-hmm. the steps for really how to do this. But I'll share a very simple outline. So you start with, okay, what was the voice that came to me? It was the misguided protector. And what was it trying to tell me? And you phrase it as, you are this, you are that, not I am, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the misguided protector was telling me that you are going to mess up here because there's a lot of risk and this will happen mm-hmm. and they'll judge you. The next step is to say to yourself, okay, when have I actually heard this voice before and taken action anyway? Because there will be examples from your past where you have heard the voice, but you didn't listen to the voice. You took the action, you did the thing, and you were okay. Mm. So you consciously remind yourself of that. Even if it was when you were a child, you write this down. The third step, what would you say to a friend or a loved one or a family member who shared that they were hearing this voice. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we get you to think about what you would say to someone else is we are notoriously bad at giving ourselves advice and guidance. We're really bad at it, but we're much better at giving other people advice. Mm-hmm. So in this way, you're thinking, how would I frame that? How do I speak with compassion? So you might say to, well, you'd write this down, you know, if this was a loved one, you've been in situations like this before. I trust that you'll be able to figure this out. You have skills, you have competencies, you are worthy, you can do this. So you write that down. And then your final step, once you've really embodied that previous one, the final step is, okay, I'm going to respond to that inner critic, knowing that it's there to try and help me. So how do I actually respond to it? So you might say, okay, misguided protector, part of my psyche, I know that your job is to try and help me and protect me and keep me safe. I understand that, but I don't need your help. I have done it before, I can do it again, and I trust myself to take action anyway. And then you take a step. So it's this very simple process of self-inquiry, of working through, it's almost like journaling prompts as well, to get you to a point where you're acknowledging it, you're not denying it, because we know if you try and deny something, it often comes back even louder, and really coming to terms with what am I feeling, why am I feeling this, and how do I respond? Mm-hmm. And what we find with people is once they go through this process enough times outside of the moment, they then start to internalize the process. So then the next time they notice a voice come up in the moment, they can just run through this process right there and then. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, it's one of the beautiful simplicities that come from research that can help us navigate some of these horrendously critical voices that make our life very difficult.
Mm. Honestly, I think that is such, such helpful advice. And I would say that one of the things that has helped me the most in my journey to from like extreme self-loathing to confidence has been this self-analysis of my thoughts, you know, and I'm constantly asking myself, why am I thinking this way? Mm. Where is this coming from? And you're right that after doing it by journaling for some time, now it is so automatic. So there is a real ability to be able to, and I'm sure we'll talk more as we go on, but I mean, I still absolutely have plenty of days where self-doubt becomes really loud. For me, it's when my emotional resilience is down, i.e. when I'm tired, when I'm hormonal, when I'm burned out, then I find it much harder to quieten those voices or they become much louder. But the ability to be able to not attach to them and not make them mean anything is just, it makes it a lot easier to come through the other side and not allow them to dictate how you feel. One of my favorite affirmations is, I am more powerful than my fears and doubts. Mm-hmm. And I think that really comes from this kind of work of being able to separate yourself and not allow them to control your behavior. I'm obsessed with your inner deceivers. I think they are just every single one. I would say most people have every single one. We just have different degrees of levels of each. And there's certainly, I was, as you were saying, some, I was like, that's definitely my friend, or that's definitely my sister, or that's definitely me. So I think it's just such a great way to understand it. Now, I want to kind of go into the ringmaster, because I think this is so relevant for our time, especially this productivity hustle kind of culture that we're in, I think is probably exacerbating this a lot, where we really link how productive we are to how successful we think we are, how valuable we are to the people around us and to the world. And I think it becomes so intertwined with our own self-worth. And I think it is really problematic. What's your kind of like take on this?
We live in a world of self-optimization where there is a tool for this and an app for that to make your life better and faster and more productive and improve this and that, to the point that I remember I had to take off my smartwatch that was tracking my sleep, because I'd wake up in the morning and rather than checking in with myself about like, how did I feel that I slept? I would go and look at my app to tell me how I slept, which would determine how I'd feel about it. I'm like, that's terrible. So I had to like pull myself back. But we live in this world that is constantly pushing this narrative of you could do more, you could be better. Mm. And also when we get into the world of comparison, we're constantly comparing because the brain is wired to compare. But comparison is what makes brilliant people feel like they're behind. Because you will always see someone ahead of you. And let's face it, we're never comparing ourselves to people who are not where we are. We're only comparing ourselves to people who are either where we are or ahead of us, mm-hmm. which fills us with this sense of inadequacy. So we very much live in this world which is fueling this sense of you are your work, you are your job title, you are your achievements. And that is such a damaging place to be because it undermines one of the four drivers of self-doubt. In fact, I'm going to just take a little step back and then we're going to come back because yeah. I think it's really important to get into here. Mm-hmm. So when we look at decades worth of research on what self-doubt really is, we find that self-doubt comes across or comes about as a result of the accumulated effect of not backing yourself on so many different occasions that you have internalized this identity that you are either not worthy, not capable, not powerful, or not able to handle the emotions that come with something. And what is so fascinating about this is that that means there are four key drivers of self-doubt. Mm-hmm. The first one is acceptance. Do you accept who you are? If you don't, that's when you outsource your worth. So what we're talking about here, the idea of attaching our sense of identity to our jobs and our performance, is a reflection of a lack of self-acceptance. The other element we see here, which is very common, is people become overly attached to external validation. When you don't accept yourself for who you are, you outsource that. And there's a part of you, the neglector, that inner deceiver, which says, you are only valuable if other people accept you. Mm-hmm. So you over-apologize, you say yes when you mean no, you don't rock the boat, you sacrifice yourself. Because if other people accept you, maybe then you might accept yourself. But then you become a shell of who you really are. The second area is agency. A lack of agency drives self-doubt. Now, what do we mean by agency? Mm-hmm. This is answering the question of, can I actually do this thing? Do I have the skills, the ability, the capacity to learn, even? Mm-hmm. When we don't have that, we keep comparing ourselves to other people and feeling like they're ahead and we'll never be where they are. We also feel like imposters. We see this a lot in high achievers and high performers. They don't feel deserving of what they've got, and they feel like someone will find out they're a fraud. That third area is really interesting as well around power. Do you feel like you have any kind of power in the situation? When you focus on things you have no control over, that's when you feel personally powerless, mm-hmm. because you are powerless to do anything about those things, and you feel like you don't have any sense of control over what's going on in your life, so you... Again, you complain about things, you feel resentful, you feel frustrated, and that's not a helpful place to be because you do not trust that you have the ability to shape an outcome.
So the victim comes
up. The victim comes up. Exactly. You're seeing how they're all coming in. And then the fourth is adaptability, which is entirely related to, in this context, can I adapt to whatever it is that I'm going to feel? Mm-hmm. I think you touched on it earlier, Roxy, that when you work on one of them, it helps all the others. And if we're experiencing a challenging day or our emotions are a little bit out of touch, you know, for us women, hormonally, we need to be so aware of that. That is something I'm becoming so aware of as I age, mm-hmm. just how fluctuating my hormones are. And I will have an existential crisis every month.
Oh, like, my God.
My husband's the one that's saying, I know what this is. Yeah. I'm like, no, you don't. Oh, no, you're right.
Last week, I'm not joking. I was like, I just don't know why I have a job that requires me to be on camera. And I just actually want to be behind the scenes. I'm just going to cancel every upcoming event, recording. And I just want to have like a quiet life and just focus on my books.
Monthly.
I mean, yeah, every month. Every yeah. fucking month. Yeah. It kills me.
And it's funny because in the moment, it doesn't feel like it's just a monthly thing. It feels like you're actually yeah. having an existential
yeah,
crisis.
Yeah.
So that's something else we need to be aware yeah. of as women, an additional complexity.
Absolutely.
But the interesting part about any of these is if you do not trust yourself in mm-hmm. any of them, that is what leads to hesitation and overthinking and not taking the step.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's now rewind.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about this idea of comparison, when we're talking about this idea of feeling like we are our jobs, mm-hmm. that is generally reflecting a significant lack of self-acceptance because we don't accept who we are outside of those external achievements or the recognition or the perception that comes with that.
Mm.
So if we then unpack, what do we do about that? We all know you are not your job. We might have said to ourselves, I am not my job, but why do we still feel like we are our job? And it's because we have to take certain actions. So Self-doubt and self-confidence are often the result of repeated behaviors that we have engaged in the past that then shapes how we see ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because identity comes through in behavior, and behavior reflects belief. So if we can update our behaviors to get new proof points or new evidence about the type of person that we are, that is what fundamentally changes our identity and how we identify. And when we can strengthen that, that is when the self-doubt becomes something that's actually useful. It's a tool, it's data. You can do something with it, rather than something that infiltrates who you are and fundamentally shapes how you show up in the world. So when it comes to, okay, someone who has a very loud ringmaster, you would start with going through the process of the inquiry and the metacognition and that reflective journaling. But there are some really simple things you can also do. I'll share two of them. Mm-hmm. The first one is actually counterintuitive. It's to go and get a hobby. And people say, why would that help? I'll tell you why. Research across 16 countries with 93,000 plus people found that people who have hobbies tend to have greater levels of self-esteem and self-acceptance. And this is a longitudinal study over a very long period of time. So there is a direct relationship between having hobbies and actually accepting who you are. When we unpack why that is, it's largely because when you're doing something outside of your usual, how you identify yourself, especially if it's something fun that doesn't have performance markers or KPIs or expectations, you're just present and you're in the moment and you're basically reminding yourself, hey, I am a person outside of all of that. Mm-hmm. You bring some joy back into your life, which almost is like an emotional reserve. So often, and Roxy, tell me if this sounds familiar, when we are so attached to our job and that's our identity, we don't feel like we deserve to have fun. We don't give ourselves moments of joy because we feel like that needs to be earned and I haven't done enough to enjoy that. And that's why sometimes on vacation, when we shouldn't be thinking about work, we're thinking about work and we're quickly scrolling and doing. Do you find that you struggle to switch off? Or have you done the work to get to a point where you can?
No, do you know what? I used to, absolutely. Okay. I really, really did. And then about a year and a half ago, it was actually on my 2025 vision board, was like work-life balance.
Beautiful.
But what I had to do was work to find out what was fun for me, because actually it was redefining fun that was the problem for me. For me, fun was going out for dinners, drinks. That is not fun for me actually anymore. What's fun for me is being with my son, being with my sister, playing cards, going on long walks, going to a yoga class. That is my joy, you know? And I think that actually being able to find presence in that has been so amazing.
So there was a study that found that Nobel Prize winning scientists are three times more likely than regular scientists to have a hobby and 22 times more likely to have a creative hobby. And they attributed those hobbies to helping them make connections that other scientists weren't able to, and helping them bounce back if they were having a really bad day in the lab. If they were having a really bad day and their research wasn't working out, they had this other fun thing they could do. And so I think that's just, again, a nice way to kind of wrap that up. Find something you enjoy. If it can be creative, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But if not, just something else. Like you said, it's the yoga, it's the walking, it's the time with family and being present in that.
Yeah.
So that's an important piece about hobbies. The second very quick tip, well, what we find in our experience and the research and what the data says, you're going to struggle to take breaks when your entire identity is work because you feel like you haven't earned it, you don't deserve it. And so what I encourage you to do is see breaks as recovery, and you cannot keep performing unless you recover.
No.
So put it in your calendar.
It's productive to rest.
It's productive, exactly.
Yeah, it really
so if you
is.
See it that way, suddenly it's not a luxury, it's actually something you need to regenerate, to be your best self.
Can I ask how this, I think that this is also something that's happening in parenting as well, where parents are keeping their kids so busy with activities. And I think part of it, I completely understand it, because there's this weird guilt that we get as parents, like, oh my God, I haven't done enough with them today, right? And I really felt like I could kind of see this starting to happen with Wolf. And I was like, actually, I know Wolf. And when Wolf gets really overtired now, he gets this extreme blinking. And it's just a sign of tiredness. And it kind of started when he traveled to Australia and had jet lag. And so there was this really clear indicator for me that he was tired. And so I started doing these chill days with him. So on a Sunday or a Saturday, when I've noticed he started doing his blinking in the week, right, on that chill day, we do nothing. We hardly leave the house except to one Sainsbury's trip. We sit in bed, we watch movies, we potter around, do a bit of cooking. We do a nothing day. As much for me as it is for him, let's be honest. And I posted about it on my Instagram, and I had such an influx of people being like, oh my God, like, I really need to do that, but would always feel too bad or feel too guilty. And I think that actually this kind of like needing to feel busy doesn't just happen at work. I think it can also happen as parents, with our families, even with ourselves. Like, a Saturday is not a Saturday. Like, we don't let ourselves just rest. We have to have plans with friends or be doing something because we think, God, like, there's something wrong with me if I just want to sit and, what, you know, binge watch TV all day.
Yes. I would say this links to what's called a productivity orientation, mm-hmm. which is also a byproduct of the world that we live in. It's like hyper-optimize, keep yourself busy, keep improving. And so for parents, it's likely that you're projecting that need that you have to be busy and achieving onto how you parent. And it's keeping things busy and achieving. And you feel guilty if you have one of these down days. Oh no, I should be there for my kid. I should be doing more with them. And that goes back to that idea of, why don't you schedule one of these rest days and you call it quality time at home or staycation or whatever it is. Give it a name that excites you mm-hmm. and excites your son, your daughter, and then make it something that can be excitable and meaningful.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's those moments where you actually get to have the conversations, where you get to be in each other's presence, have that real quality time with a puzzle or with, you know, you get them to do the laundry with you or whatever it is. You're giving it a reason, making it meaningful so that at least you don't feel guilty for it. Because again, as a parent, if you want to be the best parent you can be, you have to recover. Mm. You have to give yourself what you need.
Absolutely.
And trying to fill the schedule with things because you feel bad if you don't, it's just a reflection of a low level of self-acceptance.
Yeah.
So tap into what you need and what's going to make you happy.
So true.
And then bring your child into that.
Yeah.
A Rayo Original Podcast. A Rayo Original Podcast.
I had this experience recently, which I think I'd love your like advice on. So I had to shoot content for a brand, okay? Now, I really don't enjoy shooting content because I'm not an influencer, really. That's not my job, and it's not something I enjoy. And so I was doing it, and I was like, oh my God, I just hate this. I'm hating this experience. And I was suddenly just like, I'm not attractive enough. I'm not good enough on camera. I'm not this enough. And all this self-doubt was coming. And then at the end of that day, I went on stage, and I was giving a talk. And I was like, oh my God, I feel so much better now. And I was like, it's because I really, that self-doubt comes out so strongly if I feel I'm not good at something or if I feel like I'm not doing a good job. And I actually hadn't noticed how strong that link was. It's probably not that I don't enjoy doing content. It's that I don't enjoy doing something that I don't think I'm good at or I don't feel I can be good at. How can I be able to do something that I don't feel like I am necessarily very good at, but without the self-doubt kind of like coming in so strong? What's happening there?
So this is really interesting because now we're getting into the second driver of self-doubt, which is agency, which relates to what's called self-efficacy,
right?
Which is the belief that I can do this and I can do it well.
Right.
But it's also feeding into a lack of acceptance because you have a track record of creating content and you're very good at it, objectively speaking. And so the fact that you have a certain standard that's not being met, when it doesn't get met, you become self-critical. Mm. I'm not good enough at this. I don't enjoy this. So that's a lack of self-acceptance. Mm. So there's two elements coming into it. Something that can be really helpful is to remind yourself. So the brain operates, I like to describe it like this. The brain operates like a YouTube algorithm.
Right.
Right? So we all know how it works. You're on YouTube and something catches your attention and you watch it and you're like, that's odd. Let's say it's about rabbits.
Yeah.
Right? Rabbits eating some carrots. And you're like, oh, I didn't want to see that. Suddenly, the recommended videos for you are rabbits eating carrots. or like you're scrolling and suddenly you're seeing all these rabbits. The algorithm just goes, okay, this person spent a little bit longer looking at this thing, so let's give them more of it. Mm-hmm. We think that's what they like. The brain operates in a very similar way. If you allow one critical thought to creep in, what happens is that usually activates a whole network of other critical thoughts. And that's why in those moments, you're suddenly served up all of these elements or all of these inner deceivers, all of these critical thoughts, just because one crept in. There's this fantastic analogy shared by Dr. Daniel Amen, and he talks about ants. So let me frame it up. When I lived on my own for the first time ever, I was with some roommates and we had terrible ants, like a really bad ant problem, to the point that one time I left out a candy wrapper on the kitchen table. Went away. 20 minutes later, I came back and the entire thing was swarming with ants. Not very pleasant.
Gives me the ick.
The point is, what ants do when they come and identify food, they will leave, like when one of them does, it leaves pheromones going back to the queen to let their ant buddies know, hey, there is food. And that's how they'll find it. That's how the brain works with our thoughts. You have one negative thought, suddenly it's activating a whole network of them. So if you know that this happens, there's a few things that we want to do first. There's this whole view, I mean, I hear it a lot online, the idea of don't anticipate things that could go wrong, because then you might will it into existence. When it comes to really little things like this, like, I mean, not that it's little, but it's a contained situation where, okay, I have to create content, for example, for a client, or I have to do this thing and I really don't think I'm very good at it. Anticipate how you're going to feel. What's going to happen? Okay, in that moment, I'm going to feel irritable. I'm going to share something with you and everyone listening. I don't enjoy creating content either. And yet we've been doing it for 5 years.
Right.
And that's our main source of marketing. Yeah. I really don't enjoy it. So what I will do, and what I encourage anyone who resonates with this to do, grab a piece of paper and divide it into two pages. On the left, write down all the things that might block you from delivering, from feeling really good about it, from performing. And one of them would be, well, the critical thoughts. Another one would be, I'm going to get irritable because I don't want to be there. Another one would, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Get really clear on the things that you know are going to get in your way. And then in the right-hand side column, you actually write down, well, what will I do if this arises? What will I do if it arises? Because the first step is we need to develop trust in ourselves that even if this thing happens, we're okay. We have our recovery plan. That's what it is. So you might say, you know, if I start to feel irritable, I'm going to call five and take a 5-minute break and just go for a walk and make myself a tea, whatever it is. If I notice the critical thoughts coming in, I'm going to say to myself, this is my brain doing its job. Little side note, we find that I used to say side piece, but I've just done a lot of podcasts in America and they'd always pause. So I realized side piece is not what I'm referring to here. It's like side note. Side note. When it comes to overthinking and worrying, there is a relationship between high intelligence and overthinking.
Yeah.
So if you're getting stuck in the, I'm not good enough, this is too hard, it could also be a reflection of high intelligence because you're aware of the risks objectively, which then spikes your anxiety, which leads to more overthinking, which strips you of your confidence, and then you generally underperform. So everything you were worried about almost comes true. Okay, so you're mapping out how you'll respond in the moment. This just gives you, it increases your agency in the moment so that you know, okay, no matter what happens, I'm okay, I'll handle it. Then there's the work to try and separate your identity from the standards that you're setting.
But caring so much is part of what makes someone successful, right? But how can it not being as good as you want it to be not impact your worth at a deeper level? Like, how can it not spiral to then ruin a whole day? Like, for example, at the end of that experience, I was like, actually, you're right, we got it done and it was fine. And actually, what we created was quite good, I think. But for something else, I knew there was something else I had to do afterwards. And actually, my decision was, and I don't know if this was healthy or not, but it was, I know I'm not going to be able to get this the way that I want it. So I'm actually going to completely change tax on that because I know it's going to put me in a position where I'm going to feel so affected by not being able to do as good a job as I want to do. So let me do it in a completely different way.
Okay. And that's another strategy.
Right.
That's a form of what's called a pre-mortem, which is in the project management world.
Yeah.
Basically, so what we talked about before was this idea of like a recovery plan if something goes wrong. But you can also review something before you start it and say, what are all the things that could go wrong and how do I mitigate that from happening? So what you did there was actually very wise, assuming you didn't create huge amounts of extra work for yourself.
No.
So that's a really smart strategy. if you deep down know that you're not going to be satisfied and it's going to impact your performance, mm-hmm. you then say, okay, what other options do I have here? So here's a little tool for everyone. When we get stuck in self-criticism, we often use language of should. Mm. I should be like this. I should be better at this. I should be able to, or I should have. Like, I should have done that. I should have. How do you feel, Roxy, if I were to say to you, you really should, you should do this, you should do that. Mm. How do you feel when someone else tells you what you should do?
Yeah, no, it's horrible.
No, it's horrible.
I'm like, excuse me.
Yeah,
you don't tell me what to do.
Exactly. And this is the response. When someone tells us what we should do, we experience what's called reactance.
Right.
Because we fundamentally don't like being told what to do. It undermines two things, our agency, which is the second pillar of self-doubt, and our autonomy, which is our freedom to make our own choices. So we react to it negatively. It's also why people don't really like receiving feedback. Mm. But anyway, topic for another conversation. When we tell ourselves what we should do, we can experience the same thing. And we resist it, and it makes things even worse. And then your inner deceivers jump in. So if we don't want to use the word should, what do we use instead? Well, there was a study that looked at this specific thing. It was actually looking at it in groups of people, but it applies to the individual. And they found there's one shift you can make. You move from should to could. Mm. What could I do? What could I do? Well, I guess I could do this, I could do that, I could do that. You're not committing to anything. You're just reminding yourself there are options.
Yeah.
There are possibilities here.
Yeah.
And so you create what I call your could-do list. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you move into your, well, here is my will-do list. You pick one to three things that you will do. When we do that, when we get stuck in shoulds, what's happening is there's also activation in that fear detection center, the mm-hmm. threat detection center. We see a drop in autonomy because in these moments, we feel like everything's out of our control. We have no power.
Yeah.
So it's all feeding itself. Mm. That's because it's a default part of the brain. The moment we shift into could, we are naturally regaining attention, regaining control, seeing more blood flowing to the front parts of the brain so we can access more of the possibility seeking, the solution finding. It's so simple, and yet it is so powerful. Mm-hmm. So encourage anyone listening to write that down, the I could and the I will list.
Yeah.
And what you did is you basically did that in real time.
And could someone use that even for something like, you know, when we're telling ourselves, oh, I really should go to the gym this week.
Yeah.
You know, people say that to themselves a lot. Oh, I should eat healthy today. I should. And actually, they're actually just creating more resistance for themselves.
Yeah.
So couldn't you, even for that, you just say, well, I could go to the gym. Or would saying I will go to the gym also work?
So if it's something that you inherently deep down don't really want to do, so the gym is a good one. Because even people who work out regularly, you know, I don't know if they always want to be going to the gym, but they do it because they know it's important. So there are simple language reframes we can use in these moments to try and increase our desire to do the things that are good for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could start with your I could list. And then if you decide that, yes, because basically your I could list would be, well, I could stay on the couch or I could go to the gym or I could. So you just map these things out. Mm-hmm. Now, if someone's like, yeah, but I want to stay on the couch, what I'd recommend you do is the cost analysis. Okay, this feels really good now in the short term, but you know what? In a month, if I keep choosing the couch, this is going to feel really bad. So actually, I'm going to take that hard step now because I know that in a month, it's going to feel much better. So simple cost analysis, that's like behavioral economics. Yeah. But the idea would be, okay, so I don't want to go to the gym, but I've written down all the things I could do and I'm going to decide to go to the gym. So I'm going to change my language into get to or choose to. Mm-hmm. And I especially
like choose to
because you're reminding yourself, I had all these things I could do, but I am making a conscious choice to put what is important first, prioritize that. It's going to be easier to stay on the couch watching Netflix or whatever it is. I'm choosing to do it. And that is so powerful because at the end of the day, and I like to say this since it's a little controversial, everything you do is a choice.
Absolutely.
And it's some people will resist it and say, no, but I'm staying in this horrible job because I have no choice. And I'm like, well, what would happen if you chose not to go to work tomorrow? Well, I guess, you know, my manager wouldn't like it. And what if you chose not to go to work the rest of the week? Well, I guess I'd be fired. Okay, and is having a job important to you so you can live? Well, yes, because it funds my lifestyle. Okay, so you're choosing to go to work because it gives you an outcome that you need right now.
Yeah.
But you could choose not to tomorrow.
Yeah.
So even not doing something this is hard. And I remember when I was studying law, we did a whole ethical, it was called jurisprudence, legal jurisprudence. We were discussing ethical questions. And it was this idea of, if you omit to make a decision, is that still a decision?
Mm-hmm.
And the argument is, well, it kind of is.
Yeah.
So everything is a choice. And when you realize that, suddenly you feel a lot more, well, you want to be feeling a lot more empowered.
Yes.
To know that if there's something you're not happy with in your life, you can choose to do something about it.
I really love that, because when I talk about gratitude in Manifest, I talk about that reframe of I have to do it till I get to do it. And I think that works so well for that. But in terms of confidence building and building that self-trust, I think that I choose to is so empowering. Like if I woke up, because, you know, this morning, for example, every morning I wake up, I don't want to go to the gym.
I'm with you.
But, you know, this kind of being able to say to myself, I'm choosing to, actually makes me feel good even thinking about saying that to myself, because I'm like, I am choosing something. I am choosing myself is what I'm saying in that moment. And I think if you constantly affirm that, I choose myself. I choose to eat nutritious food today. I'm choosing to not snooze my alarm. I'm choosing to complete this task because I know I'm going to feel better. That makes me feel like, yeah, I am choosing me, which is going to make me feel like I am worthy of respect and love and discipline and all those things, which for me in turn is sending that message to the universe. I choose myself, so I want you to choose me too.
Beautiful.
You know?
Oh, I so love that, because you're right. If you don't choose you, why should you expect anyone else to choose you?
Yeah. Is there ever a version of self-doubt that's actually useful, or is it always the enemy?
Useful. No, it can absolutely be useful. It's entirely dependent on whether we allow it to infiltrate our sense of identity. So if we hear it and believe it and believe it to be fact, and it prevents us from taking action or hesitating, then it is damaging and destructive. But the goal is learning to hear it and acknowledge, this is a part of my brain doing what a healthy brain does. I choose how I respond to that. Now, I want to share this analogy, which can help us when it comes to self-doubt. And I just think it's such a beautiful visual. It's to do with a bison and a cow. So bison and cows are very similar in terms of animal genealogy and their history. Mm-hmm. They're cousins. But they have a very different response to storms, when there's a storm. So a cow has been observed to huddle when there's a storm coming. They'll huddle together or walk away from the storm. So they walk in the direction of the wind, which is coming away from the storm. But then what happens is by the time the storm eventually catches up to them, they get the brunt of it. Whereas bison, on the other hand, have been observed to walk into a storm. So they walk into a storm, and then what happens is by the time the storm reaches its worst, the bison has moved through it. And this is a beautiful analogy for the type of mindsets that we find people have when it comes towards hard things in life, discomfort in life, and even self-doubt. A lot of people live their lives with that mindset of, I'm going to run away from the storm. This thing is hard. This is uncomfortable. The doubt is too great. The inner deceivers, the inner critics are taking over. I want to escape. And then it makes life so much more difficult when they try and avoid it and they try and run away. Whereas the bison mindset is acknowledging that life can be really difficult. Discomfort is everywhere. But if I embrace that and lean into that, then generally what will happen is that I show myself what I'm capable of, and that crazy difficulty that I thought was going to come, it just passes. And so I love this, because it actually ties into the third attribute of self-doubt, or the one that drives it, which is a lack of autonomy, where people choose safe and easy and staying in bed and not doing the hard thing and staying in their comfort zone. But then they end up miserable, wondering why life has not changed and why life is so difficult, and the victim mentality comes in, as opposed to those who go, okay, I know that growth lies on the other side of discomfort. I am not going to grow unless I'm challenged. That's how growth happens.
Absolutely.
And so when we think of self-doubt, we need to acknowledge it's nothing to run away from. We just need the tools to be able to work through it when it's there. And that's why your work, Roxy, is so important. Your books are so valuable. That's why the work that we do is so important. Mm-hmm. Why the book we have, Big Trust, is so valuable, because it gives people that tools that they can use. And when people have a toolkit, they suddenly feel more equipped to handle whatever comes their way.
I love that. I love that. My next question is one that I actually get asked quite often. I'm really intrigued to hear your take on it. People often say to me, sort of, how do I know what is genuine intuition telling me I should avoid something or something's not good for me? How can I tell when it's that, when it's intuition, or when it's self-doubt dressed up as intuition?
Ooh, what a fantastic question. I would say this requires a lot of self-awareness and self-inquiry. But I generally like to think to myself, okay, if I didn't have the critical thoughts, would I still want to do this thing? Is it aligned with who I am and what I want for myself? Mm-hmm. Or would I still not want to do it? In which case, that's your intuition and you want to be listening to that.
Yeah.
Sometimes this only comes through experience where you have not listened to your intuition, pursued something and realized, oh dear, okay, I should have been listening to my intuition. Mm-hmm. So there is an element of evidence that comes. It's interesting when we think about evidence, because confidence really, when we look at what the research says, confidence comes from evidence and evidence comes from action. So we have to have proof to ourselves that we can do something, we are worthy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have made certain decisions in the past where there's been something hard and you persisted. It can actually just be, I'm going to show up in this room like I belong. Mm. That's me taking an action. And then people are going to respond to me like I belong. Mm. And that's going to reinforce, yes, I belong.
Yeah.
So this idea of, you know, is it action first, confidence first? You can actually just show up as the person you want to be. Fascinatingly, there's something called embodied cognition.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful. And I love it. And clearly, you know, it. It's this idea that when you embody the future you that you want to be, but you embody it now, you show up how that person would show up. You speak how that person would speak. You say yes to things that person would say yes to, you are more likely to believe that you are that person. Because you're showing yourself in evidence, this is who I am. And then other people are more likely to respond to you as if you are that person. So opportunities open up, you meet the right people, things come to you when you step into that. If the criticism wasn't there, would I still want to do this? Is this aligned? Yeah. This idea of intuition is a really good one when we look at people pleasers.
Yeah.
And people who seek validation and say yes compulsively. Because then a question arises, how do they know if they're saying yes because they're a good person or they're saying yes because they're a people pleaser and they're afraid of rejection if they say no and disappointing the other person? And it comes down to one thing, one signal, and that signal is resentment. Will I resent this person, this situation, or myself if I say yes to this thing? And that requires you to kind of project into the future, because often in the moment you just want to make them happy. But you need to really sit with yourself and say, okay, is spending the next 3 weekends that I have to help my friend move into her house and not have any time for me or my family, will I resent that decision and situation in 3 weeks, or will I be really happy? And that can be the difference between intuition and self-criticism, which it's interesting because people pleasers don't necessarily feel like they're self-criticism because it's so deeply a part of who they are. But asking yourself, will I resent this down the track? Or a second question could be, if no one knew I was making this decision, if no one knew, would I still do this? Mm. And that's one way that we're really checking in with ourselves. But I want to ask you, what would you say is the difference between, or how does someone determine the difference between intuition and self-criticism?
I think it comes down to how you feel. If you feel very calm and grounded as you are saying to yourself, I don't think this is right for me. I think that calmness comes from this internal wisdom. It's this knowing, and I think you should trust that. If it comes from this anxious place, this heightened place where there's a lot of fear, there's a intensity to the feeling, I think that is coming from self-doubt and fear and fear and doubt, you know? So I think it's really about the feeling. Is it intense? In which case I think it's fear-driven, or is it calm and grounded? I think that's wisdom-driven.
Beautifully said. I love that. Because self-doubt shows up in what we feel.
Yes, absolutely.
And how we feel it. And it's I come across so many people who are living lives driven by anxiety. In fact, a lot of people who have a very loud ringmaster, are driven by this underlying cortisol, and they can't switch off. Keeps them awake at night. It keeps them waking up at 2 a.m. with thoughts on the mind. And that's because their self-doubt is showing up in their bodies.
Mm.
And the better, you said self-trust, I love it. The better we can get at trusting ourselves, which really is a big part of my work and why I wrote Big Trust, to help people do that, the better we get at that, it's almost like everything becomes easier in life because we're no longer fighting against ourselves or fighting against self-doubt. We can tap into that deeper place of who am I? What is important to me?
I love that. It's, I say often, you know, people who get into nervous about things like, let's say, going on stage, let's say they've got to give a presentation or they've got to give a talk or they've got to whatever it is, you know, really self-doubt is so much about us and how we are coming across. But actually, if we can, and this is why it's one of my steps in my confidence book, be of service. Can we come back to exactly as you've put it, our impact? How is what you are doing actually not about you at all, but about what you are offering someone else? And when that becomes the focus, actually your self-doubt doesn't have space to exist because it's not about you. Actually, it's about how you can be of service. And in that, you're actually showing yourself that in spite of all your self-doubt, actually, you are so worthy. You are of value in the world. You have purpose. You have meaning. And I think there's almost no greater way to build our confidence than to feel that we are of service to other people.
So beautifully said. There's this quote that I love, and it comes from Abdu'l-Bahá. Mm. And he says, the master key to self-mastery is self-forgetting.
Mm. Oh, I love
Isn't
that.
Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
And so the idea is in those moments, you don't need more self-focus. You actually need less self-focus. And how you do that is by shifting your focus from inwards to outwards.
Mm.
How do I be of service to the people around me? It's beautiful.
I love that. Okay, so imposter syndrome.
Yes.
So what actually is it? And are people using the term correctly? Because we are hearing it all the time now.
All the time. Okay, so imposter syndrome doesn't actually exist in the literature when it was first discovered. It wasn't called a syndrome at all. It was called a phenomenon. A behavioral phenomenon that was observed in a large group of people.
Right.
And I think we need to start there because just listen to the difference between a phenomenon and a syndrome. Mm. One of them sounds common. It's just what a lot of people do. The other one, syndrome, makes it sound pathological, like something is wrong with us.
Yeah.
It's a diagnosis.
Yeah.
So I think we need to start there. Let's call about it as just the imposter phenomenon.
Yeah.
They're just imposter thoughts. So what actually is it? It is this deep belief that other people, or you believe that other people think that you are smarter or more capable than you really are. And as a result of that, you feel undeserving of your success or your achievements. And you will generally attribute your success to others, luck, or timing. So you do not take any credit because deep down you don't believe you deserved it. Now, what this leads to is two types of behavior. We will see on the one hand, people who use it as an excuse, and they feel like they don't deserve the opportunity, and so they hold back because they don't want other people to discover that they actually are a fraud and they don't deserve to be there. So they make excuses and they hold themselves back. Alternatively, we see others who are especially high performers, they feel like they have to overcompensate to prove that they are deserving, even though deep down they don't feel it. So they take on more than anyone else. They keep setting the next goal and the next achievement. And it's just this constant, perpetual chase. What's really interesting about these imposter thoughts is that we find, and research has backed this up, people who really feel like imposters tend to be really good interpersonally. They tend to have very, very strong interpersonal skills, making them better with other people. And what I find fascinating about that is when I speak to people with imposter syndrome, almost unanimously, they say, yes, that's exactly me. I'm a really good people person, but I just feel like I don't deserve what I've achieved. My view is that if you happen to be really good with people, you often get ahead much faster because you're visible, people like you, people respond well to you, and you get opportunities that maybe you don't feel like you deserve. Mm. And that's why you then find yourself in rooms where you don't have all the answers, you're stretched, and you say, I don't deserve to be here. I want to share two very simple tools for anyone who experiences this. The first one is just a simple mental reframe. No one has ever done anything new without feeling like they don't have all the answers. That is a sign of growth. If you always know how to do everything and you feel fully confident all the time, you are not growing. You are actually stagnating. Mm-hmm. So that's the first reframe. The second one is the moment you hear yourself think, I'm an imposter, I don't deserve this, there's two things to come back with. The first one is, what an amazing opportunity I have to learn and grow. Mm-hmm. What an incredible opportunity I have to learn and grow. Because you only feel that way when you are pushing beyond your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Now, the second thing, which might be more pragmatic for some people, is, well, okay, I'm here. How do I make the most of it? Mm-hmm. How do I make the most of it? I'm here. I'm at this table. I have this job. I have this opportunity. Let's just make it the best it could possibly be. So these are really simple examples of the power of reframing, which is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
But to your point earlier, Roxy, some people say, this is too simple. I don't resonate with this. Just try
it. Honestly, reframing your perspective on anything is the fastest way to think your way out of self-doubt, self-criticism, fear, anything.
Yeah.
It is so unbelievable, the power of it. I think it's something that I do all the time. You know, if I have a situation which makes me just feel a bit shitty in the moment, I just think, what is another way I could view this? And almost instantly, that feeling lifts.
Incredible.
It is so powerful. And I think people can, everyone can do it.
Yeah.
And everyone can know. And you can use the example that you said earlier, you know, what would I tell my friend right now?
Mm.
You know, how can I make this? Because I think, you know, when we're taking perspectives on anything, we have to remember that we're always viewing it through the lens of our own past traumas, wounds, experiences, our current mental state, our current mood, our current stress levels. So we're never giving an objective perspective on anything. And so we can kind of just understand that our perspective is not the perspective to take. And if it's making you feel less than, or if it's holding you back, then it's certainly one that needs to be changed. And then we can think, what is the perspective that has got nothing to do with me?
Mm.
Because that lens is always personal.
Always.
When we view it through that lens, it's always about us, what we did wrong, why we deserve this. You know, all those inner deceivers come out. But actually, how can you make it not about you at all, but about everything else?
It's an incredible reframe. In fact, you mentioned scars or wounds. I want to share a study from the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
And it was psychology professor Robert Kleck
from
Dartmouth. I love this one.
Experiment.
And I basically share it so often that sometimes I choose not to share it in the podcast, but I'm like, you know, I need to share it because there are going to be people who haven't heard it
before. Yes, please. It's one of my favorite experiments.
It's brilliant. So 70s and 80s, psychology professor Robert Kleck is conducting this experiment at Dartmouth, and he brings people together and he splits them into groups. And with one of the groups, he draws a scar on their face, on the right side of their face, between their ear and their mouth, and he allows them to see themselves in a hand mirror to confirm, yes, I have a visual disfigurement on my face. Then he sends everyone out into conversations with strangers. After the conversations, he asked them all to report how they felt the conversation went. The group that had the scar reported that they felt that they were treated differently, they were judged, it was uncomfortable, and the scar negatively impacted the quality of that conversation. Now, that in itself would be an interesting experiment, but that wasn't the point of it. If I pause and take you back right before those participants with the scar were sent into these conversations, the researcher basically said, okay, I'm going to apply some moisturizing cream to set the scar. But what they did was remove the scar entirely. There is now no scar. These people went into these conversations believing that they had a scar on their face and expecting that they would be treated differently because of that. And that is what they noticed. That is what became their reality because of how the brain is wired. There's something called expectation bias. We don't see the world as it is, we see it as we expect it to be. And so what was happening here is that these people expected to be treated differently, to be judged, to be discriminated against. And their brain, because of things like confirmation bias and selective attention, it narrowed in on anything that convinced them that their belief was correct.
Mm-hmm.
This is called self-verification. We have this subconscious desire for other people to see us how we see ourselves.
Mm.
It's William Swan. And so why this is so powerful for us to be aware of is that all of us hold scars deep within us. Every single time we are interacting with anybody, we are going to a meeting, we are having a conversation, we are at the networking event, we are whatever it is, anytime we're going out into the world, we're in our minds showing these scars to other people. And that determines whether we feel valuable and worthy and capable and powerful and in control of our emotions. And no matter what you believe about yourself, you create that in your reality because of what you notice. I like to say, we don't get what we want or what we deserve. We get what we believe. And it's because of what is going on in our brain. And that's why conversations like these are so important, because people need to understand, all of us need to understand. If you are listening to this, you need to understand those scars are not reality. They are beliefs that we hold. And the beautiful thing is beliefs can change. And you can change your beliefs by first changing your mindset or by changing your behavior through some of the things that we've spoken about. So it's so, I mean, I find it mind-blowing just how much of an influence our expectations have over everything. Now, someone then raised, when I was sharing this in with an audience, someone raised, okay, but what happens if you have an expectation that things will go well, you'll perform well in an interview or on a presentation stage, and things don't go well? You have just shattered your expectation. How do you not let yourself take that personally? So the idea behind this is your expectations shape your beliefs. Your beliefs reinforce your expectations. So if you have worked on a belief that I am worthy and I am capable, even if something doesn't go well, even though you expected it to, and I'll be honest, I had an experience like this last week in Boston when I did a podcast, and like my brain was just not with me. And it was a really important podcast, and I just feel like I completely underperformed, and I expected it to go well. So what that does is when you have a belief that, no, I'm okay, I'm worthy, I'm enough, and I'm capable, you say, well, that was a blip, and that is okay, and I can bounce forward, and how am I going to be better next time? So before this one, because this is my next conversation after that one, I had a different approach to prepare myself, get my state ready for this, which I didn't do then. So again, it's about thinking, how do I not let this become a scar? Instead, anchor in who I am, trust myself, and know that I can always learn and evolve and adapt and get better.
Absolutely. Well, when you have the foundation of self-worth, it means that you don't allow incidents that don't go perfectly well to define who you are.
Exactly.
And I think I have it the same with speaking. And I was actually saying it to my team just recently that, you know, I give hundreds of talks a year and some will go incredibly well and some won't. The audience will not respond to me well, or I am just not on my best. And if I hadn't worked on my self-worth, those would crush me, and then it would be a downhill spiral and my speaking career would be over. But actually being able to be like, that was just a moment, as you've said, how can I learn from it is so important. I think the thing about beliefs and you know, the findings of that experiment are so, so important and so powerful. And I'm so glad you shared it so eloquently. Because, you know, our beliefs really do determine our whole reality. And when it comes to manifestation, everything comes down to our beliefs. Well, you only manifest what you subconsciously believe you're worthy of receiving. And I think that with everything, we're essentially constantly creating these self-fulfilling prophecies. That is like, our life is like one big self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that it is so exciting to understand that your thoughts, your behaviors, your choices have this incredibly powerful and profound effect on your entire experience of the world. And some people may feel afraid of it when they first hear that. They think, like, it's down to me. And if their inner critic feels very overwhelming, that can feel scary because you think, oh no, am I going to constantly keep myself trapped in this life that I'm not enjoying? But the brain is so quick to change. It adapts so quickly when you start to do things differently. And I think it should give people, you know, you talk about agency. For me, that sense of agency is so important. Like, I have power in my life. I have autonomy. I have control. I can get back in the driving seat. And that's why, honestly, speaking to you, I think, has been so valuable. And I'm so, so excited for people to listen to this. Because self-doubt is always going to be there, right? But it's how we choose to respond to it that is really going to determine where we end up.
Yeah. And I have one final thing I want to share with everyone. Because anyone listening, no doubt, is committed to their growth. Mm-hmm. They're committed to being their best selves, to discovering that inner worthiness. And sometimes when you go on that journey, there are people in your life who don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And they say things like, what is the most common thing that someone might say in your life when they see that you're growing and you're evolving? What is the most common response when someone doesn't really understand? It's usually, you've changed. Mm. You've changed. And they don't mean it from a positive perspective. It's usually got hidden negative connotations because they don't like the fact that you are evolving out of the version of you that they became comfortable with. Because we like predictability. We like being to predict what the people in our life will be like. But this can be really damaging if you still struggle with any of the four elements that are driving your self-doubt. Because if you struggle with acceptance, what do? You'll say, no, I haven't changed. I'm the same. And then you go out trying to prove that you're the same person that you were that they knew. Mm. And you devolve into an earlier version of yourself to try and seek their approval. So we like to encourage a simple response when someone says you've changed. Mm-hmm. It's to flip the narrative and say, thank you for noticing. Thank you for noticing.
I love that.
Isn't that wild? It is so simple. And you take something that was not necessarily meant to be positive and you flip it into something incredibly positive. You were taking ownership of that. Not only that, you're acknowledging, thank you for noticing, meaning, yes, I have been making change a priority.
Yeah.
I've been focusing on doing that.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that you notice it.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't it great? It's so great.
And so many people relate to that.
Yeah.
Shadi, before we do a quick fire round, I just want to tell everybody to go out and buy your book, Big Trust. It's absolutely incredible. And you share so many actionable tools. It's so easy to digest. You break things down so clearly for anybody, which is everybody, struggling with self-doubt, inner criticism, imposter syndrome, go get Big Trust now. It's an absolutely phenomenal book. Okay, we've got a quick fire question for you. Okay, what's louder, fear or intuition?
Fear.
One habit that kills confidence?
Comparison.
One habit that builds it?
Making commitments to yourself and honoring them.
What does rising mean to you?
Letting go of the scars that have been holding you back and really stepping into the person that you know you're capable of becoming.
That was absolutely incredible. I honestly have really wanted Shadi on the podcast for so long, and I was just, wow, she had so much good advice, actionable tools. I related to so much of it, and I think it's definitely something that's so, well, like I keep saying, all of us struggle with self-doubt to some degree. And so I think to have a little toolkit is so like invaluable. I definitely listened back to this episode twice. Like, I'm already excited to listen to it again with a notebook because there was so much to take from it. So I would definitely give it a listen and give it a listen again. And so thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for listening, watching. If you did, please leave a comment. Let us know what you thought. Share it on social. Don't forget to tag us at Rise with Roxy. And I will see you soon. Bye.
A Rayo Original Podcast.